It's teacher experience versus a business approach in the fight to control the Duval County School Board. A look at the candidates coming up. Good morning, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9 on the radio here from Studio 5. Coming up, a look at the candidates for school board that will be on the Duval ballot. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how today's political moment is driving arts activism. That's in our Art Attack. Plus some ideas for your weekend, all of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, on November 6, voters in three districts of Jacksonville, spanning the beaches, the north side, and the west side, will elect new members of the school board, reshaping the leadership of the Duval County Public Schools. Too often these races are overshadowed by presidential or gubernatorial races, but they're very important. You need to know about these candidates and these elections and make an informed choice. Now, the three races this year in Duval point up an interesting dynamic, to say the least, as three former educators are facing off against candidates more aligned with the business community and proponents of privatization and charter schools. Here now with more, we welcome Rachel Tutwiler Fortune. She's interim president of the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. Whether you live on the beaches, the north side, or the west side, you need to know about these school board races that will be on your November ballot. Give us a call now with your thoughts and questions at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org or tweets to at Melissa in Jax. Welcome your comments on Facebook as well. Okay, Rachel, before we get into the specifics of these three races, it's interesting to note that in each contest, there's either a current or a former educator on the ballot.
Yes, and actually, we were just talking about this at the Public Education Fund recently. Of the six people on the ballot, we have five people who have at some point in time served as educators. But as you mentioned before, some people who also bring a business perspective and background as well.
Okay, let's begin with the beaches, where you've got Elizabeth Anderson, a former Duval County school teacher and mental health professional, facing Nick Howland, a businessman. Tell us about that race.
Absolutely. So both, as you mentioned, Elizabeth Anderson and Nick Howland are racing for District 2, running off in District 2 to represent the Beaches District. We also have in District 4, Cynthia Smith versus Daryl Willie, an early learning center owner and former teacher, versus the current executive director of Teach for America Jacksonville. And in District 6, we have Dave Chauncey versus Charlotte Joyce. Dave is a local attorney, and Charlotte Joyce works at Joseph Stilwell Military Academy of Leadership. This is the first time in a long time, 6 years, in fact, that we've had three of the seven seats on school board up for election. So this is a big moment for Duval County.
Depending on who wins, how will this change the direction of the school board?
Depending on who wins, we know that it's really, first of all, I'd just like to, I guess, speak to the important issues that the school board will be focused on. We have issues ranging from school safety, including the school shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, subsequent state legislation that has required armed guards at every school. We have a budget shortfall that needs to be addressed while we try to find additional funds to improve school safety and mental health services. We have to continue to focus on attracting and retaining great teachers in our public schools. Unfortunately, about one in two teachers leaves within the first 5 years of teaching. And we know that our school board is responsible for approving and denying charter school applications while also monitoring the performance of our traditional public schools and the existence of, the existing charter schools as well.
And what you see here is a contest between these former teachers who are really more proponents of traditional schools and the other candidates who are being funded, according to published reports, by moneyed business interests who are definitely on the side of vouchers, charters, privatization. There's been a lot of discussion about this, particularly as you talk about the dynamic that's also shaping up in the governor's race, where you have one candidate, Andrew Gillum, who's calling for much stronger support for public school teachers. He wants them to be paid a minimum of $50,000 a year. And the Republican Ron DeSantis, who is on the side of charters, vouchers, and privatization and expanded school choice. You're seeing that divide over education really boldly laid out in these three races. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, education can be a very political issue, but at the end of the day, we know that the vast majority of people want the same thing for our community, and that's high quality schools for all kids in Duval County. We actually have been really reflecting on how important it is that we have a school board that is able to work well with the superintendent and also well with each other to help us move our public education system forward. I think people from all backgrounds can make a valuable contribution to the vision of high quality public schools for all students. And the candidates really have to make their case to the voters on why they have the skills and background to help keep us focused in the way that is necessary to address some of the issues that we mentioned before are most pressing in our public education system while working well together to do so.
Well, but the school board doesn't work well together. I mean, and let's face it, I've never lived in a city where the school board works well together. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. The school board is always divided, always fighting, always dysfunctional here in Jacksonville ever since I can remember. And that seems to be the case in a lot of other cities, too. Now, you know, we can say, well, they need to work well together, but they're not working well together. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, voters, especially parents who have kids in the local public schools and even those that don't, because we all need a high quality public school system, just saying, no matter someone's background, they have something to offer this. I'd like to have a deeper conversation about what the traditional public school candidates bring to the table versus the business funded candidates.
Sure. And I think, you know, what we've tried to do at the Public Education Fund is to really share information about what each of the candidates has said as far as their agenda is concerned. And by and large, what we've heard is not necessarily that candidates are choosing one side or the other in the debate in the way that we're sort of describing it here. Rather, each of them has sort of articulated how, if elected to represent their district, they would really serve to represent the interests of their district, but also the entire school board around both strengthening our traditional public schools, as well as ensuring that our charter schools are also high quality and that students have the opportunity to get the education that they deserve. I mentioned before that we know that, of course, those who have that business background, I think, are often talking about how that background will relate to their ability to help balance the budget. Those who have the teaching background or deep teaching background are often illuminating how they would help us address a teacher shortage. But ultimately, the school board is responsible for all of those things, balancing the budget, really securing our schools. So some of those safety concerns, addressing a teacher shortage. These are all interrelated issues. And as teachers continue to tell us about the reasons they're leaving the profession, while we face such significant budget challenges, we're really going to have to get a school board that's working well together in order to do so. So what we've heard from the candidates is that they have ideas and a great interest in working well with each other. And also our new superintendent, who is very much about Team Duval to help us move forward.
Okay, let's talk about the budget shortfall. It's a $62 million shortfall for the Duval County Public Schools. Mm-hmm. These candidates have different takes on what to do about that, don't they?
They do, indeed.
Let's break that down. What the business candidates would do versus what the traditional educators are saying about this.
Absolutely.
What does JAXPEF have in terms of that research?
Yes. Well, we do have information about what the candidates have said their approach to these issues, or the budget issue in particular, would be. And we'd encourage everyone to take a look. We've conducted a questionnaire, and the candidates have shared their answers in response to that question on our website. That's www.jaxpef.org, where people can get more information.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about the school board races. Jim tweets the show, Educators need to be over education, not business people and bean counters. So that person is not a fan of some of these candidates. Mm-hmm. And there's been rumbling about this, that these really well-funded candidates, by the way, are getting a lot of private funding by those who are trying to really change change education through funding pro-privatization and pro-charter candidates. Particularly, we've seen this in Florida, not to a degree that's, you know, outside what we see in other states, but this is particularly a trend in Florida. And it, you know, it goes beyond these school board races. People are voting for governor based on how they feel about this issue, how we should fund our schools, how should we should educate our students, how school choice should be managed. And so I would think it's kind of a difficult job for JAXPEF to navigate these political waters.
Absolutely. And, you know, our organization, some of what we do is we, as you mentioned earlier, conduct research to really inform stakeholders. We really serve to engage the community and key education stakeholders to play the role that we must all play in advancing the public education system. One thing that I think we haven't discussed, which is worth mentioning, is the continued role of the public in this. We have this significant election next week, and that is a critical moment from the federal perspective, state perspective, and also local elections happening. But our public schools do belong to the public. And so even beyond this important and very competitive school board election, I would really encourage people to understand the continued importance of their role in helping to hold people accountable for the vision that they are articulating right now for the direction of the school district. We unfortunately heard in our poll last year that about 93% of the people who were surveyed, and this is our Education Perceptions poll, they couldn't name their school board member. And so while we're paying so much attention to these issues right now as a community, we have to continue to play our role in making sure that those elected officials are held responsible for the vision that they're articulating about how we're going to move our entire system forward while also playing a part themselves.
Here's an we'll go to your calls in a moment. 549-2937. Here's an email from a listener. Please ask Ms. Tutwiler-Fortune if it's appropriate that so many of JPEF's board members support certain candidates, the ones supported by charters. If she says that JPEF has nothing to do with them, how is it conceivable that their pro-corporate reforms, charters, and Teach for America board members don't influence their actions and policies? What about that? Can JPEF truly claim to be an honest broker in all of this, a nonpartisan and observer of this divide over education?
Sure. Well, the Jacksonville Public Education Fund's board of directors is extremely diverse, representing a wide variety of views and perspectives on education issues. And I think that diversity is actually one of our greatest strengths as an organization. What we endeavor to do through our work, and in particular our work related to the school board, is really seek to support and engage the candidates in understanding the issues and what does make for an effective school board member. We also try to educate voters on the importance of these races and on the perspectives of candidates on the issues. We don't take a side. Our organization does not take a side on school board races, and we will
still,
work collaboratively with
everyone. There seems to be a perception, at least among some teachers,
sure,
that you are a shill for corporate interests. Does that concern you at all?
Absolutely, that's concerning, very much so, in particular when we do so much deep work in partnership with teachers. We have conversations, and we do serve to be a neutral convener on these different issues. And we think it's important, as I think I'm definitely demonstrating through my articulation of sort of our stance on these issues, that people are of all different political persuasions work together, because it is only when we come together to address these issues that we're going to be able to move our public schools forward.
You know what, though? I mean, here we are now in an era where just on the cover of Time magazine, I think, a few weeks ago, you saw a teacher on the cover talking about how she had to go wait tables in order to make ends meet. You've seen teachers walk off the job in multiple states, in deep red states, places like Oklahoma and Appalachia. teachers in Florida can't strike. It is actually illegal for them to go on strike here in Florida because there was a teacher strike here decades ago, and the legislature passed laws basically forbidding teachers from striking here in Florida. So in this country, this issue is on the ballot to such a degree, and it's really been nationalized as mm-hmm. teachers literally cannot make a living mm-hmm. teaching school anymore without a side hustle. You know, this is something that just goes to the very heart of America's divide, how you feel about this. And you are a former teacher.
That's
so,
right.
You know, I just have to ask you, where is Jax Peff on this? Is Jax Peff lobbying for better teacher pay? Or at a certain point, I feel like you kind of have to come down on one side or the other. Are you lobbying mm-hmm. for better conditions and pay for teachers? Or are you lobbying for more school choice? Because if you want to improve education, you know, you've got to, I guess I'm asking for more articulated positions from
sure.
you on where you really are with this.
Yes. Well, I love that question very much because what JPEF is about is high quality public schools. And as a part of that, we basically emphasize through all of our work the importance of making sure that our teachers are respected, compensated, valued in the way that demonstrates that they are the professionals we know them to be. I am a former educator, as you mentioned, and I understand at a personal level why we unfortunately continue to lose so many great teachers. And we have research that we've been conducting throughout this current year even that really helps to elevate some of the perspectives that we've heard directly from teachers about what's causing them to leave the classroom. And compensation, as you noted, is at the top of that list.
Are you pushing for higher compensation for teachers? Do you have a position on that?
Absolutely. I mean, well, we, through our research, have actually pushed out research briefs to help inform decision makers, both at the local level and the state level, of the opportunity to continue to improve teacher compensation. We're working closely now that we have a new superintendent and other partners as we sort of navigate our own organizational transitions, but really just helping to help build that support that's necessary at all levels, community and decision maker, to make those type of improvements possible for teachers who are actually a key group that we're deeply immersed with right now.
John on the South Side. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, hi, my name is John Barnes. I just wanted to speak real quick. I had a chance to volunteer with Jacksonville Public Education Fund. And as someone who is very conservative, I usually wouldn't find myself out talking about education as much. But what I found with this organization was it didn't matter if you were conservative or liberal, Democrat, Republican. It was a lot of people who were coming together, regardless of red or blue, to try to get the word out about Duval County schools and how we, as taxpaying citizens, can make things better. So I just want to thank Ms. Tuttweiler and the organization for what they're doing, because they really are bringing people from both sides together. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, John. And I know that that's something that's important to you.
Absolutely.
Rachel. Okay. Mike in Jacksonville. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering, one of the things as far as the public school system and the image, I think they've become a scapegoat here. As far as teachers, to me, what I've heard is teachers want to teach if they're allowed to teach. We have of classroom disruptions. If they could just teach their lesson, I agree they should be paid more, but it's kind of insulting thinking that as far as that the education level will increase based on just salary.
Yeah.
What would you do as far as like answering the question why for us students? If it takes a village, can we bring in as far as more mentorship programs and after school programs to answer the question why for the students?
Thanks for that, Mike.
Yes, Mike, thank you so much. I really appreciate that point as well, because as you mentioned, teachers are not only concerned. And matter of fact, we think about, and I think about myself as I made the decision to become a teacher, it was not because I was looking to make a ton of money. What we do know is that teachers need to be valued and respected. And a part of that looks like really ensuring that they have the ability to sort of influence what's happening in their classrooms and that they're given sort of that freedom and flexibility to do what's in the best interest of their students. We've heard that time and time again from educators that, you know, not only are some of the issues that we are talking about as it pertains to compensation at the top of the list, but also, are we really demonstrating that we value and respect our teachers as the professionals they are? So I couldn't agree with you more, and our research certainly bears that out.
Greg on the north side. Hi, Greg. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you, Melissa, for taking my call. I just wanted to say your guest, and thank you for all of your knowledge, but you're dancing around the question of whether or not teachers, you are supporting, PERF is supporting whether or not teachers should be compensated. I will have spent 26 years in service, in public service. Once I retire, my plan is to become a teacher part-time. If I had started in public service 26 years ago with the compensation, I never would have become a teacher because I would not have been able to provide for my family without obtaining another job. What is your position on teachers' compensation? Simple question.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll take the answer.
Thanks.
There.
Yeah.
Rachel.
So just to be very explicit and direct, so that it's clear, our organization does believe that teachers should be compensated.
To what level?
To the level they deserve. And I just want to give you guys some very specific information about what we've heard and a concrete example about how we're continuing to push on this issue, but also in partnership with the community in Jacksonville. Just last, or the current year, actually, we're talking about January of 2018, we heard from residents in this community, regardless of how we splice the data, that our teachers are undercompensated. We specifically asked them how much they thought a beginning teacher salary was. People were underestimating that amount. But no matter, once provided the actual information that teachers are making $39,500, all the different groups in our community basically said that teachers should be making more money, and on average, about $10,000 more than they're making. And so I think now that we have a new superintendent in place, and we will soon have a new school board in place, we are eager and excited at the Public Education Fund to work with them, as well as with state officials, which have a significant role when we talk about these issues that are related to the budget and what things are prioritized, to really identify the best way to make sure that our teachers are getting those type of compensation adjustments.
And if you live at the beaches, the north side, or the west side, you need to vote on one of these school board races. Breakdowns of the candidates at jaxpef.org. And we thank you, Rachel Tutwiler-Fortune. She's interim president of the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And much more still ahead later. Some ideas for your weekend. But up next, politics and the arts. How one drives the other in our Art Attack. In a moment.
Presenter at WJCT's 6th Annual Teach Conference, an event designed to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. WJCT is seeking creative, innovative, and informative sessions for our Teach Better Together Conference. On Saturday, March 2nd, 2019, presenters have the opportunity to connect with educators from across the First Coast. Breakout session proposals will be accepted until 5 p.m. Friday, January 4th. Go to wjct.org/teach.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, here is an extremely timely topic, how politics affects the arts. There's a long history in this country of using art activism to affect the course of political events. Our Art Attack today takes a closer look as we welcome Siobhan Steele, Project Catalyst with New Company and Director of Communications, Northside Coalition of Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ed Hall is here. He's the nationally syndicated award-winning political cartoonist. Good
How
to
you
see
doing,
you.
Melissa?
Shawana Brooks with the Jacksonville Public Library. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
And Josue Cruz, a freelance writer, musician, and entrepreneur. Good to see you.
Good morning.
All right. When we talk about art and politics, I think the first question might go to Ed Hall. You've been doing a lot of political cartoons lately.
Yes.
I think that a lot of people have been noticing your political cartoons lately, commenting on the Trump administration and other things. So you use art to make political commentary every day. That's literally your job. You've been doing it to much fanfare for many years.
That's true. It's funny. I was thinking about this morning, and we were talking about how politics informs art, but art really can inform politics as well. I think it's a two-way street. I get influenced by what I read, but then I'm hoping that the stuff that I create also influences people in positive ways and helps to educate the public.
You know, it's interesting as you look at the history of America, in times of great political upheaval, the art gets really good. Mm-hmm. Art becomes almost like a safety valve for society, a way to express unease and frustration and anger and the motivation for society to change. Siobhan, you know, we've seen that locally with a lot of exhibits, and we've seen that nationally.
Absolutely. Locally, we have murals that are gone up, and the mural that we worked on with New Company was commissioned by a local chapter of a statewide organization called New Florida Majority that is pushing for representation. And so to be able to honor, you know, the first Black gubernatorial candidate from Florida on a, you know, beloved institution on the north side at Austin's. It's an amazing opportunity for us to push an issue in a palatable way. But then you start thinking about some of the other arts that come through, you know, when you think back to, Lorraine Hansberry's work of The Raisin and the Sun, she was able to bring an issue to the forefront, you know, in a time where people weren't really talking about Black issues other than Black people. And so she was able to really push that out into a broader community.
Yeah, whether it's music or a play or a painting or a cartoon or a story, delivering a political message through some art form, it softens the blow. Or it can bring people into the discussion, Josue, that might not otherwise be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it softened the blow. Sometimes I think it sharpens the message, really. You know, when you think about the use of art throughout the years, musically, you know, you talked about the explosion of music during times or tough times. I mean, the 80s brought such great music to us, you know, the 60s. And I mean, even now, the stuff that's coming out right now, it's pretty amazing to get a hold of. But, you know, if you think about the use of art, you also have to think about the converse, you know, when entities have used art in order to get message across in the 40s, you know, or during the Great World War II, when they were using art in order to, you know, get messages about bond buying and so forth. So it's a two-way street when it comes down to using art to get political messaging across.
Siobhana Brooks, do you have some favorite examples throughout history that you can think of when you think about this topic?
Oh, man, I think one of my at least favorite, most iconic imageries is the one that's like, I am a man, which kind of came from the sanitation workers at the time, just to kind of be able to get recognized. And even that, like putting work on a poster, letters, words, the literacy that comes behind that, the educational services that you have to do to try to understand if you see something and what's that about, to not just take it at face value and to do some research to engage yourself. And so hopefully within this political climate, more and more as we see kind of the de facto coming away from like these kind of instant messages at you, how do we also kind of take within that context to look past something so immediate and to go for the more deeper conversations?
Ed Hall, how do you come up with ideas every day, or how many, I don't know if it's every day or every week, for your cartoons?
I read a lot. I listen to a lot of news, and I try to listen to both sides. I mean, I'm not just listening to left wing programs. I'm also listening to right wing programs. I think it's really important to be fully informed. I also listen to a lot of international news shows versus just listening to American news shows. I think it's mm-hmm. that's really important. One other thing I wanted to mention, Josue, I think Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton is a really good example.
It's a great example, yeah. So, yeah.
In terms of music, I mean, yeah. if someone had told me 20 years ago there was going to be a rap musical about Alexander Hamilton, I'd say,
right,
crazy. Yeah. But other examples in the world of art would be like Picasso's Guernica, Spanish Civil War, and a huge influence, you know, brought that whole war into perspective for people. So it's not just cartoon, it's not just art, it's not just music. I think it's everything.
Everything. You know,
Yeah. I mean,
any creative endeavor, really.
Sure. Edward R. Murrow, decades ago, did this amazing documentary film called Harvest of Shame about basically slave labor, migrant workers in farm fields. And that was shot just down the road from here in Hastings, Florida. That's one example that comes to mind for me. But, you know, Siobhan, you're with the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville.
Right.
That's a group that's been very politically active.
Absolutely.
In recent years.
Absolutely.
Particularly around the issues of police shootings and pushing for equity for residents of the north side of this city. And so is art part of your strategy as you try to get your message out?
It is a huge part of our strategy. We have a cultural director whose singular role is to coordinate events that celebrate the history of African Americans, that talk about our, you know, their place today within the community, you know, get access to resources for arts and cultural development. You know, we're also planning a big mural project on the north side, outside of just what we did with New Florida Majority and New Company with Sage Johnson. You know, so it's something that's just an all-encompassing, right? We know that we can't solve crime with one solution, and we actually have to build the community in all facets. So arts plays a huge role in that.
Well, and the way, you know, they use the varying forms of art, you know, specifically. I mean, I'm in a salsa band in Jacksonville, mm-hmm. you know, that nobody would ever thought would have happened, or perhaps to the extent that we're doing it. And, you know, you use art the way you, you're able to, or use your art form mm-hmm. In order to get what you have to say across. And that's really when it comes down to, that's the connection you're making. You know, sometimes the political message isn't, you know, on the forefront, mm-hmm. but you're always saying something. Right. You're always, making a statement.
Let me ask you all this question too, as a follow-up. President Trump has run afoul of popular musicians the way some other presidents have in the past when mm-hmm. he plays their music at his rallies, and some have sent him cease and desist letters saying, I don't want my art associated with your politics. What do you think about that?
Good.
You agree with that?
Oh, good. Well, I think at a certain point you get, as an artist, you have the opportunity to control the message that's associated with that. And I think that there's just, at a certain point, there's an inherent disrespect when you are taking the art and culture of one group and using it for your own personal gain and benefit. And that's a struggle of representation. And so you're literally, as a politician, not reaching out to these communities, but you're willing to take their art for your own gain. We got to put that on stop.
True. Yeah. And, I'm sorry. No, and I was going to say, you know, I'd have a personal problem with that if that was happening to me. But that notwithstanding, there's this sort of conundrum of an artist putting his or her art out to the world, and hoping that it reaches as many folks as possible in order to make an impact. And then a situation such as this one happens, and, you know, as an artist, anyone would be torn. I think every artist does have a right to make a difference, or say, you know, to someone, hey, listen, that's not the way I'd prefer that to be used. But, you know, it's a weird conundrum.
It has happened to me as well. I've had cartoons that have been modified online, taken, and the entire message changed.
Mm. Wow.
Like the word bubble changed to have the exact opposite effect that I was trying to have.
Yeah.
I've actually had to go through Facebook's legal channels to have them taken down off of Facebook before. So it does happen to cartoonists too.
Interesting. Well, art is powerful. It's a powerful medium to get a message out. So thanks for sharing your thoughts today, guys. It's our monthly Art Attack, where we just talk about the power of art in so many different ways. There's such a great arts community here, so we always have great guests. Siobhan Steele, Northside Coalition of Jacks, political cartoonist Ed Hall, Shawana Brooks with the Public Library and Jacks Makerspace, and Josue Cruz, freelance writer and musician and entrepreneur. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Starvation is a creation of the devil, a rebel. I'm bringing food to the people like a widow. Bringing flowers to a grave in the middle of the city. Isolation is a riddle. To be surrounded by a million other people, but feeling alone like a tree in the desert, dried up like the skin of a lizard, but full of color like the spots of a leopard. Drum and bass pull me in like a shepherd. Scratch my itch like a needle on a record. Full of life like a man going to Mecca. Sky high like an eagle up soaring. I speak low, but I'm like a lion roaring. Baritone like a Robeson recording. I'm giving thanks for being human every morning. Cause the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a light to be blooming. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every box got a light to be blooming. Resisting the negativity, we keep it at a distance. Call for backup and I give you some assistance. Like a lifesaver deep in the ocean. Stay afloat here upon the funky motion. Rock and roll upon the waves of the seasons. Hold your breath and your underwater breathing. To be rhyming without a real reason.
Welcome back. Well, it isn't really two buckets that you think would go together, but they do. The power of storytelling in medicine is on the agenda at Mayo Clinic later this month. It's the Mayo Humanities in Medicine Symposium. Here now with more, we welcome Chris Yates, Program Director for Mayo's Center for Humanities and Medicine. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Hope McMath, Director of the local gallery and activist space, Yellow House.
Good morning.
I guess that's a fair title for Yellow House.
I'll take it. I like it.
But you can correct me on that in a moment. But let's begin with Chris. This is cool. You're having an international agenda of presenters coming into Mayo to talk about the power of storytelling in medicine. What is that exactly?
Well, in general, the symposium focuses on showcasing innovative and unique arts and healthcare programs, emerging research and innovation in the field of arts and medicine and humanities and medicine.
And who all is coming in to speak?
So we have an excellent lineup of keynote speakers and local presenters. Again, it's an international symposium. One of our highlight keynote speakers is Dr. Danielle Ofri. And she is an internist at Bellevue Hospital and NYU School of Medicine. And she writes regularly for the New York Times, Slate Magazine, and other publications about medicine and the doctor-patient relationship.
Very nice. Okay, Hope McMath with Yellow House. How did Yellow House become a partner with Mayo in this whole effort?
So Mayo Clinic and Yellow House have a partnership where we're engaged with their physician, the Humanities in the Physician program, where some of their resident physicians come to Yellow House for tours, for art making experiences, for conversation, for connections to cultural competence and conversations around empathy. But actually, that is born of a very long relationship that Chris Yates and I have had, which started in 1995 and wove its way through our careers at the Kummer, where we were doing arts and medicine-based programs really throughout the city for everybody from children with cancer to women who were low vision or blind to eventually our work with Mayo Clinic. And so as we both transitioned into other organizations, that work has continued.
So who should come out to this and how is the arts community involved in this besides Yellow House?
So typically Mayo Clinic has collaborated with a number of cultural institutions and community partners, including Body and Soul, The Art of Healing, Executive Director James Jenkins, who's the principal tubist from the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra, who Body and Soul and James bring musicians to Mayo Clinic on a daily basis, providing art and music at the bedside for hospitalized patients. We also partner with Art with a Heart in healthcare. The symphony, as I mentioned, MOCA, Kummer, and of course, Yellow House. The symposium is open to everybody. Everyone's invited to attend: physicians, nurses, physicians' assistants, social workers, nurse practitioners, healthcare administrators, artists, art educators, museum administrators.
Basically everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I think the relationship between individual artists and the work that's happening at Mayo Clinic and that will happen at the symposium is super powerful. Whether it's actors or writers or musicians or visual artists, I think the commitment of Mayo Clinic and other entities in the city to really integrating the arts in a serious way into this circle of care gives artists opportunities to find sort of new relevance and importance in the work that they do. And this symposium helps lift up that work.
Absolutely.
You know, and as I look through the agenda, there are some really interesting sessions. Here's one that sticks out: Medicine in the Movies. That's interesting. Just seeing how Hollywood has treated the medical field.
Sure.
So this goes way beyond patients enjoying beautiful artwork when they're in the hospital to help with their healing, right?
Yes, absolutely. So our mission is to integrate the arts and humanities into the hospital and clinic setting. And we do that through a variety of programs that span patient care, education, and research. So the obvious, as you mentioned, Melissa, the patient care aspect, art and music at the bedside, for example, for hospitalized patients. But it goes well beyond that, as Hope mentioned. We're quite involved in education programs for physicians, research on the impact of arts and medicine and humanities and medicine, for example, on patients with chronic pain, or relieving stress and burnout and building resiliency among physicians and staff.
There's so much on the agenda for the 2018 Mayo Clinic Humanities in Medicine Symposium. Now, this is coming up next week, right? November 10th and 11th?
Yes.
On the Mayo campus at the Kinney Auditorium. People can come for free, but they do need to register. Right?
Actually, it is a continuing education symposium, so there is a registration fee. However, people can inquire at humanitiesfla@mayo.edu.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris Yates with Mayo Clinic, Hope McMath of Yellow House. She's wearing a yellow shirt today, too.
Surprise, surprise.
It's your signature color. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Have fun.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, Weekend Ideas along with Amelia Island film producer Claire Fogg. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
Alert Today Florida, committed to safeguarding those who bike and walk. Avoiding distractions is crucial to public safety. Drivers should just drive, and walkers should just walk. AlertTodayFlorida.com, because safety doesn't happen by accident.
Vistar Credit Union, focused on delivering various loan options to its members while remaining financially strong since 1952. Vistar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
Ilhan Omar is running for Congress in Minnesota. That's a lifetime away from Somalia, where she was born. Her focus is on jobs, education, opportunity. But for some voters in Minneapolis, the focus is on who she is.
And Ilhan knows exactly what the Muslim Somali American community is going through and all the hateful things that we're hearing.
The first Somali American woman to run for office on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Millions of accounts, trillions of dollars under management, but the boss says it is not all about the money.
We're focused on building an organization and rewarding our stockholders, but ultimately it all originates with whether we're doing the right thing by our clients.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the right thing according to the CEO of Charles Schwab. Next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
How easy should it be to vote? Polls suggest there's overwhelming bipartisan support for laws that require people to present a government-issued ID. But Democratic and Republican lawmakers have taken different strategies on changing the rules. The fight for a free and fair midterm election next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, film producer Claire Fogg is based on Amelia Island, but her latest project is global. It's based on the world-renowned Vespa traveler Giorgio Bettinelli. The short film is called Il Vespista. Claire Fogg is on the line now with a preview about the project and a unique photo exhibit in Jacksonville around this. Hey, Claire, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Now, most Americans haven't heard of Giorgio Bettinelli, but he's actually famous worldwide for his love of traveling the world on a Vespa. And so you decided to make a film about this. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I was actually making a film in Estonia with the film's director. He's Italian. And this has been a project he's been wanting to make for a long, long time. So we're so happy to finally get it started.
Okay, so you're getting ready to shoot the film. You're heading to Indonesia in a week or so to start production. But people can kind of get a window into this because you're holding a photo exhibit coming up later this week, this weekend, at Intuition Aleworks. What will people be able to see?
Yes. So I have 53 photos that were actually taken by Giorgio himself in the 90s, was when he started beginning his travel expeditions. And in the past, he'd been featured in National Geographic, but mostly he's known in Italy. So this will be the first glimpse for Americans to see his photographs. And he passed away 10 years ago, so this is sort of a tribute to his legacy. So you can see photos from Thailand, from Indonesia. You can see some from Iran, all over his travels, from the first 70,000 miles he did on his Vespa.
And this is amazing. People, there's a map on your website of his travels. He literally traveled the entire world on a Vespa, from the tip of Alaska down to the tip of South America, and from Italy all the way down to Melbourne, Australia, on a Vespa. Pretty incredible. So come on out to Intuition Aleworks on the 4th to see Claire's exhibit, and go to her website, ilvespista.com, for more about the life of Giorgio Bettinelli. You know, lots of Vespa owners out at the beach. They should come see this. Claire, good luck on the film, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, and I hope to see you guys there.
Thanks so much. And that is coming up on the 4th. Meanwhile, lots of other ideas on tap for your weekend. From the county fair to Porch Fest, here as she is every other Thursday to take us all around town, we welcome the mistress of mayhem, the maven of mirth, the wearing her pajama pants this
they
morning.
They are not
Carrie
pajama
Speckman
pants.
Is here today.
These are LuLaRoe, ma'am, leggings.
I stand corrected.
I'm not saying I don't sleep in them.
They're leggings.
They're leggings.
They're like, they're yoga pants.
That would imply you do yoga in them. I just walk around in them.
Okay, so let's begin with the fair, which is up and running through mid-November.
On their website, it said it started yesterday, but I didn't see anything when I drove by.
I didn't see any Ferris wheels or anything.
Of course, it's very likely that I just drove by and didn't even notice a giant Ferris wheel. But in the event...
I didn't see it either.
In the event that it is there, it will be there through the 11th.
You got to get the cotton candy. You got to get something fried.
Do not get fried butter.
I would avoid
because
that.
Because it's literally a stick of butter dropped in the batter.
Yeah. It's don't do that. But get something fried and definitely
Snickers,
ride.
Fried Oreos.
Get on a ride that looks like it's quite rickety and could kill you. You must have the full fair experience.
And of course, they have lots of music, including Blue Oyster Cult will be playing there.
More cowbell, baby.
Exactly.
I need more cowbell. Where's Christopher Walken?
I don't know, but that they will be there.
That's amazing.
I know.
Are they going to bring the cowbell? That's all I want to know.
I would imagine so.
Okay, so go to the fair, and then also tonight, the opening of Bohemian Rhapsody at Sunray Cinema, but with a live performance.
A brief performance of some Queen songs by Mama Blue.
By Mama Blue herself. That sounds pretty cool.
I know. So that's, Sunray at 7.
Okay, and then this weekend, of course, in Springfield is Porch Fest. We will actually be live tomorrow.
I heard
From Uptown Kitchen for Porch Fest to promote Porch Fest, one of the most fun fall festivals you'll ever go to.
Or just fun event of the whole year. It's one of my faves.
Yeah.
They have 20 performers, 20 porches, and they have a big concert at night. People just walking around, being friendly, and it's really awesome. And it's kid-friendly. It's dog-friendly.
Yeah, just a great weekend in Springfield. So make sure to come out for Porch Fest. Live music on nearly two dozen porches throughout the neighborhood. And then moving ahead to the fall.
You did that math really fast. Nearly two dozen.
I am not good at math.
No, you did it.
That's about as far as my math skills go.
I'm impressed.
Okay, going ahead to Saturday, November 10th, Ira Glass, host of This American Life here on this public radio station, is coming to Florida Theater, which is
super exciting.
He has rabid fans.
Yes, he's going to be sharing lessons from his life and career in storytelling.
Yeah, so get your tickets for that at floridatheater.com. Last but not least, if you like Napoleon Dynamite, and who doesn't?
I like Tater Tots.
You can come see John, is it Hader or Heater?
Hader, I believe.
The star of Napoleon Dynamite, Wednesday, November 14th at St. Augustine Amphitheater.
KJ will be there. Deb will be there. They will show the film, and then they're going to have a discussion, a lively and freewheeling discussion.
About the cult classic.
Yes.
I love that.
It premiered at the Jacksonville Film Festival. That was the first year it came out.
That's claim to fame.
That's how ahead of time we were.
You're always ahead of your time, spectator.
Yeah, something like that.
Go to thespectator.com.
See you Saturday.
And see you Saturday at Porch Fest. For more events, go to her website. And thanks for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. And as I said, tomorrow, make sure to catch our special On the Go show live Friday morning at 9 a.m. from historic Springfield for Porch Fest. Come visit us at Uptown Kitchen. We'll see you there. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.